First today on Weekend Arts, it's English novelist and essayist Jeff Dyer. Jeff's a literary renaissance man, or gatecrasher, as he puts it. His non-fiction subjects range from photography to music to D.H. Lawrence to tennis. His most recent book, called Zona, is a response to the 1979 film Stalker by Russian director Andrei Tarkovsky. I met Jeff Dyer by the harbour at the recent Sydney Writers Festival and began by asking him about his unorthodox work practices.
I don't know how many books I've written, 12 or something. It amazes me that that's happened. And I guess I've tried on various occasions to live and work more like a sort of career writer. And it just doesn't happen for me. I mean, one thing that I am so struck by is when I acquired the habits of self-discipline very, very early on. And, you know, we'd have to do an essay over the Christmas holidays. Dreadful prospect. And I would always do it, you know, the Friday night that I finished school, not because I loved working so much, but actually because I hated it so much. I just wanted to get it out of the way. And then in this weird way, to quote Martin Amis, you know, what has life been since then? It's been 30 years of homework, just endless homework. And in one way or the other, I've just still, in a less disciplined way than I had at school, I've continued to do my homework.
But not always the first Friday night, because it seems that often it's, I think you've described it, that getting one book finished depends on having another book looming that's even more a torturous prospect than the first book.
Yeah, that's right. I find that the time I often have real trouble settling down to write a book, and it's often not until I have an idea for another book, which I can't get onto until I've got this one out of the way, that I can start really applying myself to it. And I should also say that although I've been a very diligent doer of my homework, often I end up not doing the homework that I've been assigned to do. So this Tarkovsky book, I was assigned, my homework was to write a book about tennis. I was contractually obliged to do that. And so I really commend my publishers for accepting a book on Tarkovsky.
A pretty esoteric tennis book. You describe yourself as a gatecrasher.
When I was trying to find a title for my second book of selected essays, I was going to call it My Life as a Gatecrasher, because in one of the essays about, you know, I talk about the way that I've tended to turn up uninvited at some area of expertise and have then sort of just, you know, written about whatever it is. It could be jazz, which of course there's a lot of jazz scholars and jazz experts. It could be photography, all this kind of stuff. And then after I've written the book, I've tended to move on to another party, if you like. So that's what I meant by being a gatecrasher. But then by the time this book was coming out, I realised it was a bit indulgent to have this sort of adolescent outsider idea of myself, because the truth is, since gatecrashing a number of parties and actually being so nice while I was there, then I've been invited back again, because I didn't smash the place up or anything like that, even though there were some, might have been some initial resistance. So actually, the nice thing is that, for example, having gatecrashed into the photography world, writing that book, The Ongoing Moment, now I'm really, you know, I get invited to do lots of things within the world of photography.
But I guess the spirit of gatecrashing is there in the sense that you're motivated by pleasure or enthusiasm, sort of spontaneous interest. You give a great quote in the essay on My Life as a Gatecrasher from Nietzsche about comparing sort of that stolid industriousness to the stupidity of gravity.
Oh yeah, that great Nietzsche line. You know, he says that scholars and specialists often accomplish a great deal because they have the tremendous stupidity of the force of gravity. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's about, you know, who am I doing it for? I'm doing it for me. So yeah, it's about pleasure. But it's about a number of other things as well. I mean, I'm often trying, something has happened in life, or I've encountered some artwork that's moved me greatly. And I should say right from the start that I make no distinction between the two things. It's not like there's this stuff, art, that you study at your desk, and there's the other stuff that you encounter when you're living. You know, living your life, the two are absolutely the same. So I might try to describe the thing in detail, whether it's a place or an artwork. Then I would try to work out why it had moved me so deeply, and hopefully by being very faithful to my own sort of peculiar experiences of that place or that thing, weirdly, I might end up articulating a truth about that that rings true for people coming to it with a whole different set of experiences and, you know, values and from, you know, yeah. I mean, I crop up a lot in my books. It's not entirely because I'm some sort of narcissistic navel-gazing thing. It's more that for my research purposes, I have one great thing going for me. I'm always around. You know, I'm a canary that's already in this particular coal mine.
There are, though, a few lodestars that kind of guide that canary in its various activities, and Lawrence is one that obviously is still such a key figure for you.
Oh, my God, yeah. You know, I mean, Lawrence is also inexhaustible, but what I find is that, for me, and this is what I say in Out of Sheer Age, you know, Lawrence remains a great writer, although he's, you know, his reputation has never really recovered from the kicking he got from the feminists in the 1970s. But I think the thing is that where Lawrence's greatness lies, it's not in the great novels, it's in, I mean, what you get is a sort of inversion of the classic hierarchy of genre. Lawrence is at his best in the travel books, the essays.
The letters.
In his letters, yeah. And in the, I mean, I know poetry is highly regarded, but Lawrence's poetry is at its best when it's really not much more than a postcard that he's dashing off without much thought. And the Lawrence that you get there is so fresh and alive, whereas the Lawrence of, say, Women in Love, with all that stuff about the loins of darkness, you know, that mysterious part of the body, that where are these loins of darkness? You need to be a very sort of good metaphysical butcher to find them. So just to give one kind of little example I came across the other day, it's a late poem, and he's just sitting in a cafe waiting for Frida, I guess, and she's getting off the ferry or something, and he says, and then I saw her, you know, I noticed her, the woman who looks for me in the world. And I thought, what a beautiful, what a perfect thing. And, you know, that's just, he's done that without a second thought. Or then, you know, since we're in Australia, you know, that, you know, there's the novel Kangaroo, which is, you know, people have different opinions of it. But then in the poem Kangaroo, when he talks about the kangaroo with its, it's either the kangaroo with its narrow Victorian shoulders or its sloping Victorian shoulders, I can't remember.
Which is a line you use, I think, in Jeff and Bennett's.
Yes, I do it. I do indeed. Yeah.
I had known that it was a, I thought, well, that's a great line from Jeff Dyer. It turns out it's a great line from T.H. Lawrence.
I'm always, you know, I'm always sampling other people's work.
And there are obvious, I mean, obviously part of what draws you to Lawrence, you write about this, is the parallels with your own lives, that this only child who has this chance to sort of escape a working class background but really doesn't live the life that his parents had envisaged that education would bring.
Yeah, oh great, I can now though act like a real Lawrence scholar and I can snap at you, yes, but Lawrence wasn't an only child.
Oh, that doesn't take too much scholarship.
No, how nice it is to put people in their place. I was getting such a sort of, such a thrill from that. Yeah, but you're right about the larger, you know, thing about coming from a working class background. And, you know, the thing about Lawrence is that he's the person for me who really, oh, I mean, you know, I was reading Sons and Lovers, and that was sort of dramatizing the process that I would go through. And of course, since, I mean, in a way, obviously Hardy was a huge figure for Lawrence. And if you think of Jude the Obscure, he's the sort of doomed forerunner of what will be a very common 20th century journey. That is to say, the sort of kid who's at school ends up being sort of quite good at school, and then a teacher at the school, you know, for some reason thinks, oh, this kid is bright, and then, you know, you pass the 11 plus if you're in England, go to the grammar school. And then, you know, your life options have expanded, and in my case ended up going to Oxford, becoming a writer. But there are endless versions of this. So the same thing happened in a way with Camus, you know, who had the most enormous journey. You know, when he won the Nobel Prize, the telegram sent to his mum had to be read out by the next door neighbour because she was illiterate. But there's always a kind of, and it's great, you know, it's a common phenomenon, but the experience of it is incredibly constant, I think, whatever its regional variations. And it's this idea that this thing that you have access to, literature, this education you have, it turns out that it's more than an education, and it puts something quite painful happens really to both the person who you know leaves that background, and it puts it as a price to be paid by the parents as well. So it's
a change in sensibility, not just in economy.
And it's a whole social change. You know, this very basic thing that I spoke differently to my parents. I mean, there's so much great literature of this. I think of that great Tony Harrison poem, Bookends. Do you know that? So it's written after his... Tony Harrison is another. His dad's... I can't remember exactly what his dad did, but, you know, he grows up in Leeds, gets a scholarship, goes to university, becomes this poet. There's a poem written after his mum died with a great first line, baked the day she suddenly dropped dead. We chew it slowly, that last apple pie. And then he remembers his mum saying about him and his dad, oh, you're like bookends, the pair of you, because they'd sit and not talk. Then after she's died, he says, they sit on either side of the fire and they're united by this thing of the mum's death. And he says, but still what's between us these 30 or so years is books, books, books.
I wondered, Jeff, just before we finish, in Zona, but throughout every book, you write so passionately about how art affects you, whether that art is cinema or books or music. And you also write very lovingly of your early 20s, you know, these years in Brixton where I think, you know, your homemade bong is one of your greatest achievements.
That's in my 3 A's at A level, that's pretty well it.
I wonder, now that, you know, you say you're in your 50s, does art move you in the same way, with the same intensity that it did when you were that young man?
I look back increasingly fondly at that period in the early 20s, partly because it was so much fun in that sort of hedonistic way that there's all the parties and all the kind of friendships you'd have. You know, it seems to me by the time you get to my age, you don't really have friendships. You have dinners with people. You don't have friendships in those
nights. You don't hang out.
And there's scrapes where you're always on the brink of getting into trouble and there's all the sort of... you know, all the stuff that everybody in their 20s does. But the other thing about that period is you're taking in such a huge amount of stuff for the first time. So it was at that age when I first saw Stalker, all this kind of thing. There are lots of people around who, they basically in their 40s, 50s, they're still just listening to the music they listened to at university. I find that my receptivity to music has sort of continued, but films, I think, you know, I think I'd be very... Even though I still see a lot of terrific films, nothing quite has the power of seeing Stalker. But musically, you know, I mean, I had this great thing that, you know, I discovered the Necks in my 40s. In fact, my musical path was really quite odd in that I immatured with age for a phase. I went from being a jazz fan and an Indian classical music fan. I moved from that into sort of house, techno and trance. Then I came out the other side, got back into Indian classical music, and then had, you know, this amazing thing of discovering the Necks, which is that's been as intense a musical experience as any I had in my 20s, I think.
Thank God he escaped house, techno and trance. I'll play you some Necks later in the show if we get a chance. And if you want to hear Jeff Dyer talking more about his most recent book, Zona, about that Russian film Stalker, Michael Cathcart spoke to him earlier in the year about that, and we'll put a link to that interview on our Weekend Arts website. I spoke with Jeff at the Sydney Writers' Festival, and I'm hoping that he's going to become a fairly regular guest here on Weekend Arts, sharing the fruits of his cultural gatecrashing around the UK and Europe, so stay listening for that. And his book on D.H. Lawrence, or more properly on the impossibility of writing a book on D.H. Lawrence, is called Out of Sheer Rage, and it's a very funny, often infuriating book. It's the perfect present, I think, for anyone you know doing a PhD in the humanities.